The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So here's a story. Mushin was one of the more radiant monks in the monastery. The peace and joy that seemed to beam out of him inspired everyone who met him. He never seemed to want anything. But he did have a knack of being in the right place at the right time when others needed help. No one had ever seen him bothered by anything. However, this didn't seem to diminish his thoroughness in doing his job as janitor of the monastery. Since he always seemed to be at ease with his life as a monk, one day I asked him if monastic life had ever been difficult for him. This is what he said. My life before coming to the monastery was very difficult. In fact, I had considered taking my own life because the suffering was so great. For me, the monastery was the end of the road. I saw it as my last chance. When I first arrived at the monastery, I had a long interview with the abbot. He asked me lots of questions, and I told him things about my life that I had never told anyone before. At the end of the interview, he welcomed me to the monastery. As I took my leave, I asked him what sort of spiritual practice should I undertake. He faced me and looked with such a look of compassion and confidence that my first thought was that he was preparing to tell me something very important. But I was confused when all he said was, "Always walk completely through the doors." For the rest of the day, I wondered if I had heard the abbot accurately. How could walking through doors be pertinent advice to someone in my despair? Perhaps the abbot was becoming senile in his old age. But then, to my surprise, the next day the monastery doors started talking to me. Every time I went through a door, there was a faint whisper. At first I thought I was imagining it and didn't give it much attention. But the whispering kept occurring, so I strained to hear what was being said. It seemed that each door said the same thing. By the afternoon, I was able to make out the whisper, and what each door said was, "It is all empty. It is all empty." I asked the other monks if they ever heard the voices, but none did. Then I asked them if they knew what "it is all empty" meant. They just smiled and shrugged their shoulders as if they didn't have a clue. Pretty quickly, I decided that the voices were reminding me of the life I had left behind in joining the monastery. All the possessions I had had, the many pursuits I had run after, the recognition I had sought, the womanizing I had done, all that was indeed empty. The doorway voices were reassuring me that I had made the right decision in coming to the monastery. They were reminding me that there was nothing anymore outside the monastery for me to go after. So at first, the voices made me happy. Reminded that the world was shallow, I threw myself enthusiastically into the monastic life. What a delight to have found a meaningful life. But the voices continued to say that it was all empty. And after a while, I began to have doubt about my monastic life as well. Was this life also hollow, meaningless? To add to my concerns, the voices started to speak louder. Soon, I felt as much despair about the monastic life as I had of my previous life. Trying to grasp onto something that would give me meaning, I decided I needed to devote more time to meditation and thereby develop my inner life. Certainly, the pursuit of some real spiritual attainment was meaningful. The meditation practice seemed to lighten my despair, and when my meditation was deep, I was filled with confidence. I began to feel quite happy, even happy-go-lucky. I had found the key to happiness and was convinced that I was surpassing all the other monks in holiness. But every time I left the meditation hall, the doors again said, "It is all empty." After a while, this grated me, and I became increasingly angry. I was angry because the voices seemed to imply that my newfound identity as a deep spiritual person was empty. When my anger was too much for me to bear, I finally had to admit that I had been caught in pride and that my vanity was empty. After the anger passed, I still practiced my meditation practice. After all, nothing else seemed to make sense. But then the voices started commenting on the meditation itself. I heard, "All is empty," as saying that meditation itself was meaningless. With this, my despair returned more strongly than ever. I tried hiding in my room so I wouldn't have to go through any more doors. I took to climbing through windows whenever possible. When I had to pass through a door, I ran, trying to distance myself from the voices. But by now, the voices had gotten quite loud. As I ran down the hall, the phrase, "It is all empty," echoed after me. After a while, every thought I had, every wish I hoped for, and every effort I made was attacked by, "It is all empty," resonating throughout the monastery. Finally, I couldn't take it anymore. I ran toward the front gate of the monastery. I was going to find a tall mountain cliff and throw myself off. It did not make sense to keep living if living was going to be so bad. But as I came to the front gate, the gate doors loomed large in front of me. I became too frightened to go through them. It was as if I could not survive one more voice telling me that it is all empty. After I stood frozen for a long time, I remembered the practice the abbot had given me on my first day in the monastery. Always walk completely through the doors. The instruction had seemed so empty and meaningless when I had first heard it. Now it seemed too monumental. I could not manage to get myself to pass through the front gate. Inside my head, a voice kept repeating, "It's all empty. It's all empty." My mind couldn't find anything to rest on because when it did, I was reminded that this too was empty. My mind became increasingly contracted in on itself. It was pulling away from everything until finally, all that was left was my frightened mind itself. Then, again, a voice boomed out, "It is all empty." And with that, I let go of my mind. I turned around and re-entered the monastery. Since that day, the voices stopped, and I never again worried about the meaning of anything. Neither despair nor hope are relevant for me. It is emptiness itself which lives through me. So emptiness can seem like a wonderfully meaningful, profound insight, which it is. And emptiness can be, for some people, is another way of saying it's all hollow, shallow. It can be a source of despair for people. So I want to describe to you something that can happen occasionally in meditation, when meditation is kind of deep, kind of very still, the mind is quite still. So the mind is quite still, calm, peaceful, settled on itself, safe in itself, not searching outside of itself for happiness or security or anything, settled on itself, very quiet, still. And then there can arise in the mind a thought. And you can see the thought arise. Because the mind is so still, there can be a sense, it's not so interesting to go and get involved in that thought. In fact, to get involved in that thought, I'm going to lose touch with a sense of safety, of well-being, contentness, happiness, spaciousness that's here in my awareness, is settled here. To get involved in that thought train, I start getting agitated, pulled off, distracted, pulled into worlds where I'm distracted from this deep sense of peace. And so it can seem very natural then to just let go, not get involved, just let it pass. The thought bubble comes up, you let go of it, or it just floats away. That's very different than how the mind normally operates for many people, where thinking is almost as, you know, it's like the air we breathe, you know, we don't see it. It's just part and parcel of what goes on all the time. And the seeing the arising of a thought, that's not, we're just always in them. You know, we find ourselves, if we're aware that we're thinking, we're often aware that in the middle of the train of thought and our concerns, and one thought leads to another and chain of associated thinking. But when the mind is really quiet and settled on itself, it's possible to watch the arising of a thought. And not only see that it's not interesting to go there, but to see that in some way that thought is insubstantial. I think it's easier to see that a thought is insubstantial than a wall. But it's, you know, what's the weight of a thought? What's the shape? What's the color? It's not even insubstantial enough to be transparent. It's not even transparent, right? It's just, what is it? It's just like, probably the most insubstantial thing in the world, a thought. And thoughts can be of all kinds of flavors and colors and themes and ideas. And from that very subtle place, it doesn't really matter if the thought is the holiest thought humans ever had, or if the thought is the most demonic. Just, oh, I don't want to touch that. I'm not interested in that. There's this good place I'm in here, right here. And some of the thoughts come up and they have these little fingers and say, come here. I'm really important. This is really essential you take care of. Hey, you're not going to be safe unless you join up with me. So there's all these kind of, come. But because you know this really good place where you feel safe and settled, and not now. So you see how insubstantial it is. What's interesting is if you watch this phenomena of thinking arising, if you can have space of watching it, you start seeing that pretty much everything that we cling to is clung to through the filter of a thought, through thinking, through a concept. And in fact, I would venture to say that it's kind of hard to find that we cling to something which is not a concept. So this is a little bit kind of building on what Guy's talked all earlier about. It's, you know, what we're focusing on in Buddhism is not so much what the world is, but what our experience of the world is. And those are two different things. And our experience of the world is so much mediated, not only by the electrons that go up the optic nerve and things like that, but also by how we reconstruct this world, how the concepts we form, the thoughts that we make it happen. And it's really a phenomenal thing in quiet meditation to watch that constructive activity occur. And you can watch the construction of self, of me, myself, and mine. And you say, well, who am I? Who are you really? And then we can have an endless debate about who the true self is, or the true not self is, and you know, we might come into blows, as Guy said, over these very, you know, things that people have a lot of passion about, self and not self and all that. But if you should relax, if everybody take a deep breath and relax, forget about this teachings of self and not self, get really calm, really still, and watch the arising of a self thought. The rising of a thought, this is who I really am. Oh, just one of the more of those thoughts. I think I'll stay in that quiet place. I don't need that thought, thank you. Well, who are you when you're not telling yourself who you are? Who are you when you don't tell yourself a story, a thought about who you are? And if there's no thought that tells you that you need to answer that question, what then? So these thoughts, me, myself, and mine, can be seen as insubstantial, as a creation of the mind. And it's possible to see the stickiness, the glue that's connected to it. All the fingers saying, come here. All the ways in which we, you know, it seems so important. It's possible to watch that and the impulse to get involved. It's possible to see all that. But it's also possible to stay settled and just say, sayonara, bye-bye. I'm not going to pick you up. I see who you are. Thought, I see you as a thought. You're just a thought. And I don't have to leave my quiet place, my peaceful place, in order to engage you. You can do what you do. And then you start realizing how much of our experience of ourselves, the world, is mediated through these concepts and ideas. And then a very important thing can happen is when you start questioning what these thoughts are and what our involvement with them is, and more importantly, is there an alternative? Is there a different way of being than clinging, attaching to thoughts? Is there a different way of being of clinging to concepts or pushing the concepts around? You know, if you push a lot of concepts around in your mind, it's a good thing to do. I like to do it. I do it regularly as well. But you have to always remember that if you're pushing around, rearranging the concepts in your mind, it's a little bit like rearranging the deck chairs in the Titanic. You know, it's nice that it's nicely arranged when it goes down. So, seeing the emptiness of thoughts, the insubstantiality of thoughts, leads to seeing the emptiness and insubstantiality of so much of what makes up human life. It's not to dismiss all those things. In fact, it's possible to be very friendly and warmly engaged in them and creatively engaged and all that. But the idea in Buddhism is not to be tricked by it and think that's where life is and I have to arrange life that way. And also, but more importantly, is to know there's an alternative. And so thoughts, concepts are empty. But the other kind of emptiness that sometimes is talked about is the mind or awareness, which is empty of clinging. Empty of the activity of selfing, me, myself, and mine. Empty of delusion, empty of hate, empty of all these things. And it can be very challenging to be up against that possibility of a mind which is freed from this stuff. I know that in my practice, my early years of practice, I came to a place in my practice where I could see the delusive quality of my self-clinging and self-identity. I could see how I was creating a self-identity for myself and how I was trying to play the self game, present myself to people a certain way so they would see me a certain way back, and this whole self thing. And I could see it was empty, insubstantial. It was, you know, I could see. And I knew that I had to let go of it. And I was afraid to. I couldn't. I was up there against that fear. It took me a while to take that next step because of the fear that was there. So this emptiness thing can be very frightening for people as well. But it's also offered as the supreme medicine. It's offered as a great medicine. That understanding, seeing emptiness. You know, understanding that thoughts are insubstantial. That, I don't know how useful that might be. But to actually be still enough to watch a thought and see it being insubstantial, arise and pass, that's a whole different thing. So to see the emptiness in our moment-to-moment experience, to see how insubstantial it is, and then perhaps be on that edge where it's, uh-oh, I didn't sign up for this. This is frightening. Because, you know, where am I going to stand now? And so emptiness is a profound practice that takes us to the edge. And let's see. So then there's time for another story. And I have to remember it from memory now, so I didn't bring it down. Well, I'll just make it up new. So there was this fellow at the monastery. He was really a diligent practitioner, very sincere, really applied himself hard to the meditation, to the monastic life, to the study, everything. And he made no progress whatsoever. Nothing, nothing, nothing. He didn't let go of any of his clinging. He didn't see anything about how, he didn't see anything, any insight to selfing. All these great teachings of Buddhism, which he understood intellectually, just didn't make any sense to him. And he sat down to meditate, and his mind was always distracted, and the more he tried, the more he seemed to tie himself in knots. It wasn't working. It was not a good, pretty picture. The abbot, who was a brilliant abbot, tried everything. Tried every technique, every teaching, everything to try to help him find his way in this practice. Nothing worked. So finally the abbot said, "We only have one option left for you. We're taking you down to the basement, to the red door." Now, the red door in the basement had this vibe. And the monks, all the monks in the monastery, when they went by that door, they always walked as far away from it as they could. No one wanted to get close to it. Sometimes they actually tried to avoid going down to the basement at all because of that red door. And no one really knew what the red door was, because no one had been, in a generation, no one had been through the red door. But the abbot either knew it from his youth, or the knowledge had been passed on to him, and the key to it had been passed on to him. And he had instruction, this is the last, you know, for some certain people, certain kinds of person, this is the only hope. So he took him down to the red door, and he stood outside and said to the young monk, "There's a simple instruction. You're going to go through this door into this room there. And all you have to do is walk to the other side of the room and out the door there. That's the exit. That's all you got to do." Seemed easy enough. The young monk said, why is everyone afraid of this room? What's the issue? So the abbot suddenly opened the door and pushed the monk through and closed the door and locked it. And the monk found himself standing on a ledge that was 1 foot wide and looked down, and the room was a huge abyss. And every once in a while these flames would shoot up from the bottom and these great kind of grinding sounds would come up from the bottom. He couldn't even see the bottom, you know. And he stood at this edge, you know, and the door was behind him, and you know, just up against the door and this ledge and this abyss. And then he remembered the instructions. He had to walk to the other side. And you could see on the other side of the room, it wasn't a very big room, but you could see on the other side there was an exit door. It said exit. you know, the laws now, you have to have a light on this exit sign. And so he said, "There must be a mistake." So he thought, "Well, maybe, you know, the ledge goes around." And he looked around, and it only went, you know, a foot on either side of the door. It didn't go around. And he looked up, it was swing across, you know. "Maybe I can jump." "No, it's like 30 feet. I can't jump 30 feet. There's no running start." So what to do? So he stood there for a long time, and they started banging on the door, turned around and said, "Help, let me out. There's a mistake. But of course, no one heard. No one answered the door. So he stood there, wondering, what was this going on? And he was there so a day, a couple of days passed. He just barely kind of sleep on the edge a little bit, but he started kind of tipping over. He'd wake up. And there was no food there. 3-4 days passed. And the instructions was to walk to the other side, but to the other exit door. But there's this abyss. It doesn't make any sense. So after a week of this, and no one was coming to open the door for him, he said, "No one's going to help me." The instructions were to walk across the other side. So he stood on the edge there of the abyss. And he put 1 foot out a little bit, tentatively. It's crazy. You don't step into an abyss. You don't just fall. So he pulled back. So a few more days went. So I'll try again. So finally, he said, "Okay. There's no other, it's hopeless. I'm going to fall over. I'm so weak here, I'm going to fall over and die anyway. So I might as well follow the instructions. I'll take a step. towards that exit door. So finally, he took that step into the abyss. And as he did that, the ledge grew out in front of him and received his foot. And then it took him another day before he's willing to take the next step. But as he did that, the ledge grew out and received him. And then he stepped across, and the ledge, the floor grew up as he did, and he was able to walk out the exit. And what he had learned was he had learned to trust, to let go, and step into the unknown, into that which offers no support, that where there's nothing there to hold you up, nothing there to provide you with the answers, nothing there to tell you what's next. And each of us, each moment actually, is on that abyss. Each moment is an abyss. Who knows what the next second calls for us? Who knows, we walk out this door, we're going to find as we walk out, or as we... anything. Our life can be turned upside down in the next moment here. We're running a couple of miles from San Andreas Fault. All kinds of things can happen. Who knows what's next? So what does it mean to step into the next moment without holding on to anything? And is that okay to do? Is that a safe thing to do? So this experience of emptiness, which is a very profound experience, a very profound realization, has its frightening aspects as well. Because so much of what we usually support ourselves with and build ourselves up and orient ourselves to the world with is seen as insubstantial. And it can feel sometimes as if we're taking that step. And the beautiful thing is that every time you take that step, it seems that the ledge grows to receive you. Isn't that nice? But if you believe it's going to do that, it won't. So can you let go? So, we have a few minutes if you'd like to comment or questions about that. And any of those stories or any of this emptiness stuff? Yes, so take the mic, please.
I think one of the aspects of the emptiness teaching is the connection, interconnectedness. I sometimes think of it like an ecosystem. Things are always codependent,
yes,
codependently arising. So in answer to your question, to me it's not scary if you think of it as just connection, that when you step off the ledge, I'm really into you or to you or to all of us, rather than to some voidness, so that the emptiness isn't a nihilistic or denial of being. It's an assertion of the connection.
Beautiful. It's a beautiful thing you said, and what you said is echoed by many spiritual teachers, many Buddhist teachers. So I don't want to pull the rug from under it exactly, but to take off on take as an entry point, as a response, to take off from the word codependent, which in English nowadays has a little bit of a unfortunate kind of connotations. The teachings of emptiness is often likened or synonymous as dependent co-arising. That the person who sees emptiness sees dependent co-arising, sees how things rise dependently. For whatever sociological reason, here in the modern West, the idea of everything being interconnected is seen as a really good thing. And you to use the word, rather than nihilism, it's an assertion. It's a positive thing. The best that reading I could from the teachings of the Buddha, he understood also how things are dependently arising. But for him, it wasn't a solution. It was a problem to get liberated from. And a guy talked earlier about the delusion of the separate self. A lot of people nodded, that's a separate. The separate self is delusive. But the idea of a non-separate self as a connected self is also a delusion. So is there some alternative to nihilism or a positive assertion? And I think the emptiness teachings, as the Buddha taught it, is actually a third option or the middle way. And it's not to make a positive assertion about interconnectedness, and it's not to make a negative assertion about it, but it's to be free in the midst of it. Does that make sense? Guy, you want to respond to that or critique that?
No, I'm very happy. It's just that I was going to spend the afternoon talking about compassion and connectedness.
You come to IMC and it's an abyss.
I'll cross that when we get there.
Yes. Oh, here, we can pass this one over.
I just appreciated when you said about the that it takes you to the edge, because I've, in my years of practice, I've had a couple of experiences of what you two have been talking about, and I had a psychotic father, so I was fearful that if I let go, that psychosis may occur for me.
Yes.
And what happened instead is that despair did arise for me out of one of those experiences, and ecstasy out of the other one, and they were both transitory. Mm. So anyway, but I think it's really, I think at some level I knew that, but it's, I don't know that I've heard somebody state that clearly before. Mm. And certainly that's what happened to me.
Great, thank you. And I know plenty of people, I met plenty of people who had similar situation to you, where some relative, you know, has had some kind of psychotic break, and so they're afraid in meditation to go there because they're afraid something that's going to happen to them as well. So that fear is, you know, common enough. And the experience of emptiness, the deep experience of letting go, it's, you know, sometimes it's better not to have that experience quickly, you know, soon after a person started practicing. You know, let's, you know, some people, I want to just, you know, I should be enlightened, you know, quickly, you know. But I think we have to be very respectful of what a powerful thing it is to work with the mind, self-identity, clinging, the concepts we have, and how difficult it is to work with some of these deeper experiences, deeper realizations, unless the soil has been prepared, or the ground has been prepared for it. And much of Buddhist practice is also preparing the ground for this, so that when we finally let go in some deeper way, we do it in a context that is, supports that and provides just a lot of well-being and rightness for it, as opposed to confusion or fear or all that disorientation. So things like the precepts are very important. Compassion is very important. Cultivating compassion, loving kindness. Cultivating mindfulness and self-understanding. There's a whole slew of things that need to be cultivated rather than rushing. Yes. Take the mic, please. It's been passed.
Hi. When you describe the feet stepping out over the abyss without any support, I just wanted to say that this year has been somewhat like that for me. I'm a special education teacher, and I took a new job, and I had a room full of students with issues, and I had what I perceived as a total lack of support in dealing with it. And I thought I could, you know, have all these different reactions. I chose to just open myself and just to say, okay, I have this situation. I can either react, you know, like get angry or have all these emotions, or I can just calmly open myself and allow myself to feel compassion for these kids and to say to myself, ask myself, what can I do to help these children? And by just keeping my focus on that, and believe me, there was some stuff that went down. I could regale you, but I'm going to spare you with all the, you know, stories and so on. But by simply keeping that point, I was able to step into this abyss where I was told I was going to keep control of these kids, which no way. I knew I wasn't going to be able to do that. But even though everybody around me, all of my colleagues and superiors and evaluators and all this were telling me, you know, you're terrible, you're wrong, everything you're doing is completely mistaken and all this kind of thing, somehow I found the strength in me, and I have to give credit to some wonderful friends that I have, to James Barris, whom I mentioned before, his Awakening Joy class. And actually, I went to Spirit Rock meditation for a day like this with a friend I was invited. Somehow I was able to find that, you know, the letting go, this just relax with it. Like, no matter what people say to you and what, you know, I could feel angry, I could feel sad, I could feel all these things, but that's going to take me off my point, and my point is, what can I do to help these children?
Beautiful. Beautiful. So one of the things we can rely on in emptiness is our intention to be compassionate. And it's beautiful to evoke that now as we go to the transition to the afternoon. And it was, I think that what we find is that the emptiness leads to compassion, comes out as compassion, and becomes support. Compassion becomes a support for this place. It's beautiful that you had that experience. And I understand the difficulty of changing jobs. That's part of the challenge. A small thing to say is that when I was in the Tassajara, the Zen monastery, we'd have a new job almost every 3 months. And when I was there, I felt that it wouldn't... very few people have so many job changes over a lifetime. And what I found was each job had different challenges for me and called for different things within me. And so I was challenged in ways, over 3 years, in ways that some people maybe not, don't over a lifetime, because they always had the same job. So even switching classes or situations, I think is so valuable. Just getting a new environment, new situations, and it seems like you've done really well with it.
After 32 years, I'm retiring in 2 weeks.
Well, that'll have its challenges too. New job. So let's take an hour for lunch. Let's start again. Let's try to start in here at 1:30, 1:35. And a couple of things. There is out in the table, one of the tables out there, a sign-up place. Just if you want to be on the Spirit Rock mailing list, so you can get the kind of Spirit Rock newsletter. They do a very nice newsletter twice a year, and their catalog of events and things. So maybe many of you are already on it, but those of you who aren't, it's a nice thing to do. Sorry? I did already when you were out of the room. I did those other two things I did. The other thing is, because, maybe it's lunch break, it's kind of break and it all, tell you how meaningful it is for me personally to participate in an event which is fundraising for the scholarship fund at Spirit Rock. It's just profoundly meaningful. And so maybe at lunchtime that little reflection will also be meaningful for you. So thank you.